gubernatorial candidates cagey on their education picks. Expanded vote by mail almost definitely a no for November. Plus, more PPP loans needed and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending September 4th, 2020.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Democratic gubernatorial candidate Woody Myers won't say who he is considering to appoint as the first state superintendent of public instruction since the law was changed. From WFYI's Education Desk, Eric Weddle reports he wants someone who supports traditional public education over school choice.
The General Assembly changed state law in 2017 to replace Indiana's elected education chief with one appointed by the governor. That will happen after the November election when current state superintendent Jennifer McCormick finishes her term. On Saturday, Woody Myers told a group of public education advocates he would attempt to reverse many school reform measures put in place in the past decade, but he would not say who he would appoint as the new state superintendent.
I'd like to certainly appoint someone who fully believes in quality public education for our kids, who understands the needs of our families across the state, who prioritizes public education over the private interests of corporations.
Myers says the ideal candidate would also have administrative and classroom experience. Republican incumbent Governor Eric Holcomb has not said who he would appoint to the position.
Should voters know these picks before November 3rd? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, should voters get to know before the election who each gubernatorial candidate would choose to be the first Secretary of Education in Indiana?
I think that the legislature, in its wisdom, has decided that the governor has the responsibility for education. And whoever the governor picks, whether it's the incumbent or whether it's Dr. Myers, it's going to be somebody that reflects their point of view. If you vote for Woody Myers, you know you're going to get a superintendent of public education who supports traditional schools, wants to expand preschool and kindergarten, knows the teachers are underpaid, and is going to take steps to rectify those situations. You know that if you get the incumbent, you're going to get a promise to have a study commission who's going to have a study commission who's going to have a study commission. And sometime in the next 10 years, we might have full access to preschool. We might have teachers paid in comparison to the rest of the Midwest. But you're not going to get any kind of bold action on the part of the incumbent. So you know already what you're going to get for public education without knowing the particular name of the individual who's going to carry out the plan for that governor.
Mike O'Brien, should voters get to know who the person will be before November 3rd?
No, I don't think the person's nearly as important as these two candidates discussing what their goals are for public education in Indiana. I don't think Ann's wrong in that. I mean, it's worth noting that every gubernatorial candidate or governor, going back to Joe Kernan, supported this move and this the superintendent being appointed. And that was because voters who already blamed or credited the incumbent governor. They all get reelected, Ann. So you know, good luck in the future.
They either would
blame or credit that governor with his or her performance on public education. So it makes a lot of sense. It also, if you announce it now, it also potentially limits as a practical matter, the candidates that might be available. You may have top tier candidates and top tier jobs right now running big school systems or running big universities or doing other things in life. And they don't want to say 4 months before they might potentially leave that based on the outcome of an election. If you're Woody Myers, who has about a 1% chance of winning this and some catastrophic turn of events, who's doing something real in life right now? Who would say, yeah, they'd leave to go work for a potential governor, Woody Myers, who has almost no chance of winning? So, as a practical matter, I don't think this makes any sense.
Or who would go for a governor who doesn't support public education like your incumbent?
John Schwanis, I want to ask: is the person incidental here? Is the policies that the governor will pursue more important?
Well, presumably now that this will be an appointed position chosen by the governor, one would assume that this is simply an extension of the governor. And terms of his policies. I think anonymity between the policies of the governor and those put forth by the state superintendent of public instruction. Now, I think it, by definition.
Well, we're having a little trouble with John.
I agree on the issue of.
Yeah, John, you're breaking up quite a bit right now, as is unfortunately the perils and downfalls of doing a virtual show like this in the midst of a pandemic. But Nikki Kelly, I want to ask you.
It was the best, and it was the smartest thing I have ever said.
Nikki Kelly, I want to ask you, based on what we've heard now from Woody Myers and what we've heard from Eric Holcomb the few times we've gotten to talk to him about this, what would you say is the likelihood that we get some sort of name before November 3rd?
Given how both of them reacted, I would say we're not going to get it. I mean, I got to come down on the side of transparency, especially in this particular situation where Governor Holcomb, you know, just recently lobbied for the choice of a voter to be taken away for that position. And I want to point out that back when Mitch Daniels ran, he wanted to appoint a Secretary of Commerce. And you know what? He named her Pat Miller, who ran Vera Bradley at the time, one of the co-founders. And she campaigned alongside him for several months.
All right. Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question: should each candidate for governor tell voters before the election who they'll name as education secretary? A yes or B no. Last week's question we asked, should Indiana drop its coronavirus restrictions before a vaccine is widely available? Just 16% of you say it's time to do away with those. 84% say let's keep them in place. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, this week, a lawsuit trying to force Indiana to expand vote by mail this fall is headed to a federal appeals court, but its success looks unlikely after an earlier court ruling against it. And Indiana Secretary of State Connie Lawson insists the state will have a, quote, normal election this fall without expanded mail-in voting. There are about a dozen reasons you can legally cast a mail-in ballot, including if you're confined to your home by illness. Lawson says fears over COVID-19 for those in high-risk populations might fall under that provision.
But if you're still going to the grocery store and running other errands, you're not confined to your home.
Even without expanded vote by mail, Lawson says the state expects a significant increase in mail-in ballots this year.
We are working with the post office to ensure that ballots are prioritized by the Postal Service and are received in a timely manner.
Still, Lawson encourages those who want to and can vote by mail to request their ballot and return it as soon as possible. Indiana is one of just six states that refuses to expand vote by mail this fall. Mike O'Brien, since this is likely the last time we'll talk about this particular issue during this election cycle, Governor Holcomb has emphasized the importance of in-person voting. And it looks like we're going to have robust in-person voting both before the election and early voting and on election day. But why not give Hoosiers the choice between in-person and vote by mail?
Well, he did that in the primary, and it's because there was a stay-at-home order in effect, and the government can't tell you simultaneously to stay at home and also leave to go vote. Now, the restrictions in other places, as we just saw today, Marion County is going to approve on September 8th bars and nightclubs to be open, starting on September 8th. And so the legislator, or the governor and secretary of state both determined that there was no reason to go and put a stay-at-home order in place or expand an emergency order to give them the authority to expand the options. Now, there are a dozen options available already to vote by mail. One of them is you're 65 or older. So some of these risk groups have already been addressed in the existing law, the existing permission of to vote by mail. And I think the Secretary of State and the governor decided, as everything else is beginning to open up, there are plenty of options now in the 30-day window that you can vote in smaller groups in person at your county courthouse or vote at a vote center on election day or vote absentee under one of the dozen options that are already available. There are plenty of options even given the pandemic while Indiana started beginning to reopen in a meaningful way.
And Delaney, with so many more early in-person options, with more polling places available on election day than there were for the primary, and with much of the Indiana economy reopened, why do we need expanded vote by mail?
Well, Dr. Fauci has just said that there are Midwestern states, Indiana included in that list, by the way, that are about to see a surge in the coronavirus. This is a political decision, plain and simple. It was a political decision on the part of the Republican Party not to encourage more voting. They think they have all their people registered and that their people will turn out and that any additional voters are going to vote against the Republicans. And so this was a political decision from beginning to end. I mean, Mike Pence can vote by mail. Donald Trump can vote by mail, and that's somehow okay. But the rest of us don't have that opportunity to do it across the board for whatever the reason we want. I mean, we're one of, what, half a dozen states that don't permit this? It just shows you that Eric Holcomb is afraid of offending Mike Pence and Donald Trump, and that's what this is all about. Because if he wanted to encourage voting, he would make it as easy as possible, and they're not doing that, plain and simple.
Nikki Kelly, the question was asked, and we heard an answer from Connie Lawson about this. One of these provisions that Mike O'Brien just mentioned, which was if you're confined to your home due to injury or illness, and it might have even been you who asked the question of Connie Lawson, if you're worried about contracting the coronavirus, does that count? I don't know if we got a very good answer to that question.
Well, I think she said it might, depending on how you're handling it. And I don't know that we have a bunch of investigators who can be going out and seeing if, you know, John Thompson over here is eating at Applebee's but wants to, you know, vote from home. Well, let's just put it this way. I do not understand why this has become a line in the sand thing, and no one can coherently explain why not to allow this simple clarification about if you have a fear of illness. I mean, there are lots of 50-year-olds who have underlying health conditions and aren't going to restaurants and are picking their groceries up through click list, and they might prefer a different option, especially given the fact that not a single county I've talked to is going to have as many polling locations as they did 4 years ago in a presidential election. So there are going to be lines, and I mean, this is just another way to get around it, but they don't seem to be supportive.
I want to just note that that was an unpaid sponsorship for Applebee's and Nikki's answer. John, we're going to...
And Clicklist.
Yeah, and Clicklist, that's true. John, let's see if this works a little better this time. I want to ask, so it looks like barring some sort of Hail Mary from the Seventh Circuit, we are not going to have expanded vote by mail in Indiana this fall. What impact do you think that might have on the election itself?
Presumably, it might take turnout down a little bit because there will be people who are concerned, as we have talked about, that they are worried about being exposed to the virus for any number of reasons, their age or their underlying conditions that they may have. So I think it might suppress it a little bit. I think to Nikki's point, since the Secretary of State has not weighed in with a definitive answer on this, I think it basically is carte blanche for any Hoosier who feels nervous to vote by mail, to request an absentee ballot. I think it would be pretty bad optics for any official to come down on somebody who says, hey, I was worried about my very survival, about my health. And when questioned on this issue, the chief election officer of the state didn't say I couldn't. I think this is basically a license for people who are uncomfortable to request an absentee ballot and submit it. I cannot imagine that there would be any repercussions.
As Nikki pointed out, there's a letter about this.
Yeah, as Nikki pointed out, though, there's not a lot of investigators running around checking on these things.
Right.
Whether you have one of those reasons or not, make sure to request that ballot and get it back in as soon as possible. All right. Well, 1 in 5 small businesses in Indiana will have to permanently close by November without another round of federal loans. That's according to a small business advocacy group. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports the organization is urging Congress to pass additional Paycheck Protection Program loan funding.
The National Federation of Independent Business estimates more than 80% of small businesses that received a PPP loan have used all the money already. The PPP program was designed to keep businesses from permanently shutting their doors due to COVID-19 by issuing forgivable loans to keep employees on payroll and pay rent. NFIB Indiana State Director Barbara Quant says lessons learned from the first round of loans show there needs to be more effort to get it to the mom-and-pop stores.
It needs to be something that's targeted for the smallest, small family businesses that are not going to make it without it.
Quant says the organization is advocating for other measures, including businesses being protected from COVID-19 liability lawsuits and regulatory protections.
John Schwanes, federal lawmakers are headed back to Washington, D.C. soon, but does a deal on any sort of relief package look any more likely?
Well, a few weeks ago, I said I thought a deal was inevitable, that the political pressure would simply be too great not to do to pass something. But now you hear, and maybe it's posturing and part of the negotiating process, but when you listen to Nancy Pelosi, when you listen to Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, who's negotiating on behalf, apparently, of the White House, I'm beginning to think my earlier optimism may be, have been premature. There seems to be, a billion-dollar-plus gap in the overall number, plus there seems to be a real sticking point over how funds would be divvied up. And one of the biggest sticking points seems to be aid to state and local governments, with Congress, at least Democrats in the U.S. House, wanting larger numbers to flow into those areas, Republicans wanting less. So presumably, if Indiana is any indication, and I think it is, of what's going on in 49 other states across the country, it would probably behoove governors and those who have the ears of Republicans on Capitol Hill to say, free up those funds, because we are going to hurt otherwise. We're hurting anyway. We'd hurt even more so without those dollars.
Yeah, Governor Holcomb this week asked about that issue, said they'd like some more help from the federal government, whether it's loosening the restrictions on the existing CARES Act dollars or new funding to help fill those gaps in the budget that are coming.
Nancy Pelosi heard him.
I'm not sure that's who he was talking to, but apparently that's who he's got the ear of at the moment. Nikki Kelly, does this start to become an election issue for folks who are running for office at the same time that no deal is getting passed?
Yeah, though, frankly, I think the momentum sort of lost itself during this August recess. I mean, it seemed like they were really going hard at it. And now that nothing's happened for weeks, I don't hear as many people talking about it. And I do hear some more comments about, you know, national debt. And that up until now has seemed like something that we didn't care about anymore. But anything they do is certainly going to hurt the country in the long term. And there's no way they can do anything that will save every business. It's just not possible.
Yeah. Anne Delaney, play prognosticator for us. Do you expect another federal COVID relief package before November 3rd?
No, I don't. I think that they've drawn lines in the sand, and particularly with Mitch McConnell, I don't think there's going to be a relief package. And, you know, I think the things they're talking about doing by executive order or by fiat by the dictator who's in the White House just don't cut it. I mean, we need actual money to go to people so they can pay their rent and buy their food, and that's not happening, and I don't think it's going to happen, unfortunately.
Mike O'Brien, same question to you.
Yeah, I think they will, but I think it'll focus on checks to directly to taxpayers, because politically, what's better than handing everybody a paycheck in October? I mean, that's clear. That's the one thing. If you look at what both parties are saying right now, and I'm not being trying to be funny about that, it's just what they're both saying right now. Yeah. They've both taken stimulus checks and next another round of stimulus checks off the table. It's something they all agree on. And if they can't get to a fundamental agreement on relief for small business or clarifications on what existing dollars, like the $1 billion that's still sitting in Indiana, and we don't know how to use it, if they can't send state and local government clarity on how to use these dollars and send them more relief, then they'll send out the paychecks and call it an election, I think.
All right. Well, with just a little less than 1 month left to respond to the census, community groups are working to ensure everyone is counted. The U.S. Census Bureau will stop counting at the end of September, a month earlier than planned. That could threaten the accuracy of the census if many people go uncounted. Kelly Kors is executive director of the Evansville Department of Metropolitan Development. He says they're working with the local census office to target historically undercounted neighborhoods during these final weeks to ensure a complete count of the region. Since mid-July, the census has been conducting in-person follow-ups across the country. The Census Bureau is urging the people to answer the census questions by phone or online at census.gov. Nikki Kelly, I want to start the discussion with this because I think this sets the table for a lot of it. Why is the census so important?
Well, I think a great example is the discussion we just had. A lot of that coronavirus relief money that has come to the state has been apportioned around the country based on population. So, and that's happens with pretty much all federal programs. So this is the point of doing the census, is making sure we're getting our fair share and making sure that all our citizens are counted. You know, so, I mean, that's the big thing, is just making sure we get our cut of the money.
John Schwanis, now, folks who aren't in the political process here talk about the census and say, yeah, sometimes the census offices around the country finish counting a little ahead of when they thought they were, just based on the success rate they have. But I think what's driving a lot of the fears about that early cutoff date this year is that the process was already sort of disrupted by COVID-19. So how concerned should Americans be that this count is going to be less than accurate?
Well, it was disrupted, yes, by COVID-19. It was also disrupted even before that by court challenges over what questions could be asked and what sorts of issues might be construed as political gamesmanship as opposed to an honest attempt to get a true count of the citizenry. So this has been, you might say, a controversial, trouble-plagued census from day one. And that would lead one to conclude, I think, that the numbers would be less than perfect. You're right. In some places, jurisdictions do get done counting early, but I can't imagine that that would necessarily be the case this time around. You have people, their attention is focused elsewhere.
Yeah.
You know, media attention even. Normally, we've talked a lot more about the census at this point, I mean, collectively. And keep in mind, people are very reluctant, I think, now to fill out anything, answer any phone questions. And if someone shows up at the door, heaven forbid you'd answer. I mean, people can't, contact tracers can't get through to people. So,
what is the census worker going to do?
Might be dismissed as scam artists. They're going to are having a lot of trouble.
Mike O'Brien, how much has this become a political or even an electoral issue?
Well, it becomes a big one if you can't count accurately and all these states redraw their legislative maps on the basis of bad numbers and bad data. I mean, you've got particularly minority neighborhoods right now and poor neighborhoods where the national data shows that the percentage of people that are counted in those areas is drastically below what it was in 2010. If you look at Indiana, we've actually done a decent job. If you look in central Indiana, we're right about on average where we were in 2010. But we've got to go redraw nationwide legislative and congressional maps, state legislatures do, on the basis of this data. Forget everything Nikki already described on the relief dollars and other that just come to states and communities in the course of normal business, much less in a pandemic.
And Eleni, how worried should people be about this count?
Oh, I think the chances of this count being accurate are slim to none and slim's left down. It's one of the most botched jobs I've seen. And it's one of the most fundamental functions of governments, right in the Constitution, that we shall do a census every 10 years. And this administration's incapable of doing the basic kinds of things, how to count the people. So I don't think there's any chance that this is going to be accurate across the country. And I don't know what that means for the allocation of dollars, as well as the allocation within districts, even of congresspeople.
Yeah.
I mean, we may lose the Congress. We may lose the seat in Indiana. Who knows? But he has completely botched the census, and I have no confidence it's going to be accurate.
All right. Well, Indiana housing advocates say the new federal eviction moratorium is an opportunity for the state to address the larger housing instability crisis. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention announced this week a halt to many evictions through the end of December. The moratorium comes with a lot of qualifications. People have to prove they've lost income during the pandemic and must attest under penalty of perjury that they would have nowhere else to go if evicted other than something like a homeless shelter. Prosperity Indiana's Andrew Bradley says the moratorium has the potential to help more than 300,000 Hoosier households, but he notes individual courts will likely be the ones determining whether people qualify.
And I think that's where we could start seeing problems, unless we take a step back and have a statewide housing policy response.
Bradley says such a response should include a task force that brings together landlords, tenants, and experts in public health and housing.
To really think through how we can take advantage of this moratorium so that we're ready for when it's lifted again in January.
Bradley suggests the state should also reopen its rental assistance program, which closed last week. Mike O'Brien, will the state take advantage of this moratorium to help address the underlying issues that exist?
Well, I think the state has already recognized that from a, whether it's tenants' rights or other issues, that last session the governor vetoed a bill that did that, or that put limits on tenants' rights. So I think the state has already seen this and seen that the impact that the pandemic has had on this. I mean, the problem with the CDC's action is that it's indiscriminate, and it doesn't necessarily help people that really need it in exchange for people that really don't.
Well, that's going to have to be the final word on this Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Stay safe. Stay healthy, wear a mask, and join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.